From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! How the great stadium swindle turns public money into private profit. A congressional panel launches an investigation into the use of public financing to build sports complexes like the new Yankee Stadium. We'll host a discussion with Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who is heading up the probe. Then, Black America, a neglected priority in the global AIDS epidemic. As President Bush prepares to sign a multi-billion dollar bill to extend his AIDS program overseas, a new report accuses the federal government of doing too little to fight AIDS among African Americans here at home. And we'll look at how the vast majority of African American and Latino families are at risk of falling out of the middle class. All that and more coming up. Republican Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska has been indicted on 7 felony charges for receiving payments and gifts from the now-defunct oil services company Vaco. Stevens is the longest-serving Republican senator in U.S. history and is the former chair of the Appropriations Committee. He's the first sitting senator to face criminal charges in 15 years. Acting Assistant Attorney General Matthew Friedrich announced the charges.
According to the indictment, the total amount of gifts that Senator Stevens is alleged to have received over the duration of the offense is greater than $250,000. Also, according to the indictment, these items were not disclosed on Senator Stevens' financial disclosure forms, which he filed under penalties of perjury, either as gifts or as liabilities.
The indictment said the oil company Vico bribed Stevens by paying for extensive home renovations and giving him a new Land Rover and other gifts. Vico has been at the center of a major political corruption scandal in Alaska that has already resulted in the convictions of 3 Alaskan state lawmakers. Last year, the CEO of Vico, Bill Allen, pleaded guilty to conspiracy and bribing public officials. Stevens is up for re-election this fall. He's in a tight race with Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich. Talks to expand the World Trade Organization have collapsed after a week of negotiations. The United States and other industrial nations have been trying unsuccessfully to expand the WTO since 2001 after a trade meeting in Doha. The chief of the WTO, Pascal Lamy, admitted yesterday the talks had failed.
I think it's no use beating around the bush. This meeting has collapsed.
Lori Wallach of Public Citizen said the U.S. and other nations now need to move on to a new agenda fixing the existing WTO rules. Wallach said, quote, "Thank God no deal was reached because the proposal under consideration would have exacerbated the serious economic, food security, and social problems now rocking numerous countries." The WTO talks failed in part because India and other developing nations demanded the right to protect their farming sectors against sudden surges in cheap food imports. The Bush administration was attempting to push through rule changes that would have given U.S. corporations greater access to markets in India, China, and other nations. And in Iraq, the U.S. Air Force has begun flying missions with a new unmanned fighter drone known as the Reaper that is designed to carry out so-called hunter-killer missions. The remote-controlled Reaper is a larger and more lethal version of the Predator drone. It carries a mix of 500-pound bombs and Hellfire missiles, as well as high-tech video surveillance equipment. The U.S. has reportedly more than doubled the number of unmanned hunter-killer drones operating in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past year. The Wall Street Journal reports one of the most prominent advocates of the invasion of Iraq is now exploring investing in Iraqi oil fields. Former Pentagon advisor Richard Perle is reportedly part of a team discussing a possible oil deal with officials of the Kurdistan Regional Government. Perle was chair of the Defense Policy Board in the lead-up to the Iraq War. He's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute think tank. In other news, the British government has announced there will be no prosecutions over the death of journalist Terry Lloyd, despite an investigation that blamed U.S. troops. Terry Lloyd was shot dead in Iraq in March 2003, along with a French cameraman and an Iraqi interpreter. 2 years ago, a British coroner ruled that the U.S. troops should be prosecuted for the unlawful killing of Lloyd, who was a well-known foreign correspondent for the British television network ITN. The coroner ruled that Lloyd was shot in the back by Iraqi soldiers. Then, as he was being driven to a hospital in a civilian minivan, Lloyd was shot in the head by U.S. troops. China is being accused of censoring the internet ahead of the opening of the Olympic Games. Journalists working at the main press facility have been blocked from accessing the website of several organizations critical of China, including Amnesty International and Reporters Without Borders, as well as the religious organization Falun Gong. Earlier this week, Amnesty accused China of failing to honor its human rights pledges by jailing several high-profile dissidents. And attorneys for Amnesty, Mark Allison, singled out China's treatment of human rights activist Hu Jia, who was recently sentenced to over 3 years in jail.
Now, Hu Jia has been in prison, too, on similar charges of subversion. His trial was politically motivated, completely unfair, and he should be released immediately and unconditionally. His wife is also a human rights activist. She is being harassed by the police, who are standing outside her home, monitoring her movements. She has a newborn baby born at the end of last year. Meanwhile, her husband is in prison, and he should be released.
The American Civil Liberties Union has issued a new warning about the growing network of fusion centers where federal, state, and local law enforcement officers collect and analyze information about potential threats. The ACLU warned that many local and state police agencies are expanding their intelligence gathering with little oversight. Many of these fusion centers collect reports not just on crimes, but suspicious activity. Earlier this month, it was revealed the state police in Maryland had spied on peaceful anti-war protesters and critics of the death penalty, even though the activists were committing no crimes. About 58 fusion centers are currently operating in cities across the country. This is the ACLU's Jay Stanley.
Fusion centers are part of a much larger trend here, a trend of our nation's movement towards a surveillance society where our every move and our every transaction and our every communication is scanned and scrutinized for signs of quote-unquote suspicious behavior. And that kind of vision for how to do law enforcement, how to stop terrorism, becomes the justification for really keeping tabs on all of us in our everyday lives.
Israeli troops shot dead a 10-year-old Palestinian boy on Tuesday during a protest against Israel's construction of a wall through the West Bank. Witnesses said the boy, Ahmad Musa, died instantly after being shot in the forehead. The shooting took place in the village of Niling, the site of another controversial shooting earlier this month. On July 7th, an Israeli soldier was captured on film shooting a rubber bullet at a handcuffed Palestinian man. In science news, a large chunk of Arctic ice measuring 8 square miles has broken free of the northern Canadian coast. The block of ice is believed to be the largest piece of ice shed in the region in 3 years. On Capitol Hill, four members of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee have called for the resignation of Stephen Johnson, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. The senators accused Johnson of misleading Congress about why the EPA decided to deny California a waiver to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Senator Barbara Boxer of California said Johnson had, quote, become a secretive and dangerous ally of polluters. In other news from Capitol Hill, the House has apologized to black Americans for more than 140 years after slavery was abolished. The House passed a resolution that apologized for the, quote, fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery and Jim Crow segregation. An Army recruiter in Texas has been suspended after he threatened a potential Army recruit who was having second thoughts about joining the military. The recruiter, Sergeant Glenn Marquette, warned a young man, Irving Gonzalez, that he would be sent to jail if he decided to go to college instead of joining the military, even though the teenager had signed a non-binding contract that left him free to change his mind before basic training. This is part of what Marquette told Gonzalez.
As soon as you get pulled over for a speeding ticket, they're going to see that you're a deserter. Then they're going to apprehend you, take you to jail. So guess what? All that lovey-dovey, I want to go to college and all this, guess what? You just throw it out the window because you just ruined your life.
After the Texas station KHOU broke the story, Republican Congressman Ted Poe hinted Congress may have to investigate Army recruiters. Poe said, quote, our country cannot deceive its citizens. Since the Army hasn't taken the initiative now, Congress may have to get involved. And a New York City police officer has been stripped of his badge after he was videotaped body-checking a bicyclist during last week's critical mass ride. A video was posted on YouTube showing the officer, Patrick Pogan, violently knocking the cyclist off his bike. The officer then arrested the cyclist and charged him with attempted assault, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest. The police have said the charges against the cyclist will likely be dropped. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman will be back from her much-deserved vacation on Monday. A congressional subcommittee has launched a probe into the use of public financing to build sports complexes like the new Yankee Stadium. The Domestic Policy Subcommittee of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, chaired by Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich, will hold hearings this September on whether land for the new stadium in the Bronx was wildly inflated to justify nearly $1 billion in tax-free bonds. Congressman Kucinich is looking into whether city officials overvalued the stadium site by 7 times its actual price. The Yankees would have avoided the bondholders would have avoided millions in taxes because they would be exempt from paying taxes on interest they earn. Meanwhile, the Yankees have requested an additional $336 million in tax-free bonds to help complete the stadium. In a letter sent earlier this month to Yankees President Randy Levine, New York Assemblyman Richard Brodsky noted that the tax-free interest earned on the stadium bonds would, quote, normally would go into the city's coffers to pay for schools, police, and health care. Today, we host a discussion on public subsidies for sports stadiums. Congressman Dennis Kucinich joins us from the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. I'm also joined here in the Firehouse studio by two guests. Bettina Damiani is the project director of Good Jobs in New York, and Neil DeMoz is a writer and the author of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. I'd like to begin with Congressman Kucinich. You have, as of last week, made a request to the city of New York and to the New York Yankees for a variety of documents as part of your continuing investigation into possible abuses of federal laws and IRS regulations relating to these kind of stadium projects. Could you tell us what you're trying to do with that investigation and why you decided to focus in on New York and the Yankees?
Well, this is a project that's imminent, and we have the thing that I think is, you know, caught my attention is when you have an independent appraisal of the land that the Yankees want to get for their new stadium of $45 per square foot, and yet the city had an appraisal that appraised the same land at $275 a square foot. Now, what our committee's trying to find out is does the city's assessment represent a deliberate inflation of the value of the land so that there would be a greater number of tax-free bonds issued, thereby raising questions of, an inappropriate increased diversion of federal tax monies for this kind of private project.
Now, you have been, for now several months, actually questioning the IRS about the original waiver, in essence, that they gave the Yankees a few years ago and the New York Mets for the building of their hugely expensive stadiums. Could you tell our viewers and listeners what is the crux of the concern that you have with how the IRS is functioning?
Well, in 1986, there was a change in the tax law which made it very clear that stadiums could not be using these tax-exempt bonds to construct these professional sports stadiums. The IRS had a ruling in a private letter that essentially gave the sports teams the ability to make payments in lieu of taxes, which was kind of a loophole that enabled them to get to the point of being able to participate in these tax-free financing schemes. And so I've had a hearing where we talked to the IRS, asked them for an explanation, and from what I understand, as a result of our hearing, they're reviewing their policies to see whether or not the 1986 Tax Reform Act has actually been compromised by the decision that they made. I think that it's important to understand that we're not alleging at this point that there's been any kind of criminal activity. We're simply reviewing all the information that's been presented to us so that we can determine, first of all, the discrepancies in the appraisal, secondly, the public policy issue of using tax-exempt bonds for these stadiums, and third, if there is an inflated value of this project, the implication that it has for security laws with respect to the issuance of the tremendous amount of bond financing.
I'd like to ask Bettina Damiani from Good Jobs New York, this whole issue of this thing called pilots or payments in lieu of taxes for use of repaying these tax-exempt bonds is a very complicated issue that the general public doesn't understand. Your organization has been in the forefront of questioning these kinds of development deals by New York, but also by extension by many municipalities around the country. Could you break down how these pilots work generally?
Certainly. And it's not just the average New Yorker. As we learned through the Yankee Stadium Project, most New York City and New York State elected officials don't quite understand the issue of pilots, which is part of the crux of this issue. Essentially, pilots are payments in lieu of taxes. Instead of paying taxes, the Yankees are paying back their tax-free bonds. So there's money that should be going into, as Assemblymember Brodsky mentioned, the pot of money that would help pay for roads and schools and other services that New York City needs. Instead, it's being completely diverted. And this, unfortunately, is a policy that is not done just with the Yankees, but with a variety of other very large financial firms that have managed to make a special deal with New York City.
And in this particular case, it was actually in the interests of the New York Yankees to have a very high assessment of their land, because that would allow them to be able to float more bonds and pay more pilots, which is their main goal here, is to raise as much money as possible to build their stadium, right?
Exactly. And that's the irony, and it's one of the things that you mentioned in your article yesterday, is that in the South Bronx, the city was trying desperately to inflate the value of property, but not to benefit the larger community or the people that live in the neighborhood, but really for the sole benefit of the New York Yankees.
And Neil DeMoss, you've been writing now for quite a while about these stadium boondoggles. Virtually every major city in America is building a new arena or a new stadium of one kind, and most of them are using some degree or other of public financing. Could you give us a sense of the overall national picture?
Sure. I mean, I think it's absolutely correct that every major and minor city is either building a stadium or arena or being asked to estimate somewhere around $2 billion a year of public money going into these buildings, a very, very small percentage of which comes back in terms of, you know, tax benefits or actually benefits to the cities. You know, when the Yankees and the Mets first announced their deals, Mayor Bloomberg said, oh, you know, we don't make subsidies, we make investments and we get our money back. At the time it was announced, well, the Yankees and Mets are going to be paying for, you know, all the construction costs of the stadium. As you look at it and break down where they're getting tax breaks and where they're getting, you know, sort of hidden subsidies, the taxpayers wind up paying most of the costs.
And Congressman Kucinich, you originally had scheduled your hearing for this week, but then decided to postpone it until September. Have you been in conversations with the city of New York and with the Yankees about them also testifying at your hearing, or and what documents specific are you trying to get from them now?
Well, I could say that my subcommittee staff, and again, I'm the chair of the Domestic Policy Subcommittee, which has jurisdiction over this matter, and our subcommittee staff is in contact with officials of both the city of New York and the New York Yankees to discuss their potential appearance in front of our congressional subcommittee. I think that it's very important to understand that we're looking at a public policy matter here that relates not only to New York and not only to the Nets and the Atlantic Yard project, but it also relates to the whole country, as your other guests have said, because it's quite possible that there are billions of dollars in tax benefits that should be going to municipalities for the purposes of repairing their infrastructure and for schools and other things, and that are instead being diverted for these private sports complexes. And the question is, one of public policy, one of the IRS, and in the case of the New York Yankees, questions of securities law, because of the various amounts of the appraisal, $45 a square foot versus $275 a square foot, which have a bearing on the overall cost of the project. And if the cost of the project's inflated, that's going to be of interest to the SEC as well as the IRS.
And in terms of the, you're not at this point contemplating subpoenaing any records. You're figuring that they will provide you the documents and the information that you requested to avoid that potential.
Well, you know, we generally assume that we'll get cooperation. I mean, certainly as an investigative subcommittee, if we need to enforce our request with a subpoena, we have the ability to apply for that. But we're not at that point yet. You know, we're hopeful for cooperation on the part of all the parties involved. And I think that, again, this is a matter of serious public policy. When you have New York City, a great American city, which has all these capital infrastructure needs, and when payments get diverted, essentially, our payments are not going into areas where the city expects the tax revenues will be coming from, and instead are diverted in these payments in lieu of taxes. There's serious matters that need to be discussed, and so that's why the work that Mr. Brodsky is doing, the other guests are involved in, is very significant. We're going to continue with our work as on the Domestic Policy Subcommittee, and we'll be sure to keep you posted.
Okay, we're talking with Congressman Dennis Kucinich in Washington, and here also Bettina Damiani of Good Jobs New York and Neil DeMoz, the author of Field of Schemes. We're going to return in a minute and to continue the conversation. And before Congressman Kucinich leaves, we also want to ask him about the hearings in Congress, the potential impeachment hearings. We'll be back in a minute.
Can you catch? Will you hold the ball when you step to the plate? Will you swing and fall? If you play, you gotta know how it's done. Can you catch? Can you hold a hard one? I mean, baby, do you know the game? I mean, baby, do you know the game?
Baseball Boogie by Mabel Scott. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about the use of public subsidies for sports stadiums. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich. And here in New York, we have Bettina Damiani, the project director of Good Jobs in New York, and Neil DeMoz, author of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. But Congressman Kucinich, you've been leading the fight for impeachment, and I know you have to go very soon. So I wanted to ask you about an interview with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that aired on The View earlier this week. She was asked about impeachment.
You've ruled against impeaching George Bush and Dick Cheney, and now Kucinich is trying to pass that. Why do you insist on not impeaching these people so that the world and America can really see the crimes that they've committed?
Well, I think it was important. When I became Speaker, and this, by the way, a very important position, President, Vice President, Speaker of the House, mm-hmm. I saw it as my responsibility to try to bring a much divided country together to the extent that we could. Mm-hmm. I thought that impeachment would be divisive for the country. In terms of what we wanted set out to do, we wanted to raise the minimum wage, give the biggest increase in veterans' benefits, mm-hmm. the veterans in the 77-year history, the veterans pass the research for stem cell yeah. research, all of that. This week, we're going to pass equal pay for equal work. It has been a long time we're trying to pay equity. We're going to pass legislation for product safety, for toys that children put in there. There's an agenda that you have to get done. You have to try to do it in a bipartisan way. The president has to sign it. If somebody had a crime that the president had committed, mm-hmm. that would be a different story.
Can they still do it after he's out?
When I interviewed you last year, you had just begun and you were going to clean up the mess, remember?
We did.
You look around this country, 75% of the country, forget George Bush, thinks that Congress is doing a lousy job.
I don't disagree with that, because largely it's predicated on ending the war in Iraq. That's the main question. And we were not successful. In our House of Representatives, I'm very proud of our members, because they voted overwhelmingly, over and over again to bring the war to an end, bring the troops home safely and soon, send it to the Senate, and it hits a dead end. But in terms of that particular standard, I would say I disapprove as well. But we do. We passed some of the things I just mentioned, the energy bill. We worked in a bipartisan way, an innovation agenda. We have to create jobs, expand health care, protect the American people, and educate our children. And you can't do that if you're trying to impeach the president at the same time, unless you have the goods that this president committed a crime.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Congressman Kucinich, your response to her take on the situation with impeachment.
Well, now that I've heard that the speaker is looking for evidence that crimes may have been committed, I certainly want to direct her attention to the 35 articles of impeachment that I presented, which assert quite directly that crimes have been committed, including taking this nation to a war, an illegal war, based on lies, and including the deaths of over a million innocent Iraqis, which constitute a war crime, including wiretapping, rendition, torture, illegal detention. There are many examples of laws that have been broken, and the reason why the Judiciary Committee should hold a hearing on the impeachment itself is because there needs to be a public airing of this. So I have a great deal of respect for Speaker Pelosi, and I think that since she made that statement on The View, there's an opportunity now for us to come forward and to lay all the facts out so that she can reconsider her decision not to permit the Judiciary Committee to proceed with a full impeachment hearing. I just want to state this, that I appreciate that she consented to a hearing on Friday. It was a six-hour hearing. Over a dozen witnesses, 24 members of Congress attended. It's being taken seriously. I think the idea that nothing can be done right now because we're on the eve of an election raises questions about our constitutional responsibility to be a check and balance to administration abuse of power. If, in fact, we're in a war that's based on lies and we have thousands of troops whose lives are on the line every day, we owe it to them and we owe it to the American people to set straight the public record. And then whether or not it results in the president being removed from office before the end of his term is another matter. I want to further say that with the possibility of a war in Iran in the offing, a war against Iran, a war that would be a result of a preemptive attack, much like the one that the United States launched against Iraq, it becomes very important that we hold this administration to the highest standard of having to verify the statements they make to take us into one war and to try to take us into another.
Well, Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, thank you once again for joining us. And we're going to continue the conversation here on the stadium issues with Bettina Damiani of Good Jobs New York and Neil DeMause, author of Field of Schemes. I'd like to, again, getting back to the stadium deal. Yankee Stadium is the most expensive stadium in the history of the United States. It's the actual cost is very hard to get your hands around because there's some public infrastructure subsidies. But we're talking about a stadium that is going to be somewhere between $1 and $2 billion when you add up all the actual costs, probably closer to two. And Neil, could you talk about how the public expenditures are being used, even though we're being told that public money is not being used directly for the stadium?
Sure. I mean, it's something I've been trying to track ever since this was first announced 3 years ago. There is, as you mentioned, this infrastructure cost where the public is paying for building new parks to replace the ones that were torn down to make way for the new stadium, paying for moving a water main and other things like that.
Well, and when you say parks that were torn down, because that was a big issue.
Yeah,
this is public parkland, about, 20 acres?
It was like 22 acres that was actually demolished. It was a park that had been there even longer than Yankee Stadium, that was demolished to make way for the new stadium. To make up for this, the city and state had to make sure that there was an equal amount of parkland that was created. So they're knocking down the old stadium completely. Originally, the team was talking, oh, we're going to save it as a museum. It's going to be gone starting next year. And they're going to put some ball fields there. And they found some space down by the Harlem River where they're going to squeeze in some tennis courts and sort of a little patchwork of parks around different places. The public's paying for all of that. The public's paying for the actual demolition of Yankee Stadium is all going to be public. the public is paying a good chunk for building new parking garages for the Yankees, including one that will be used by the players and VIPs and various folks like that. And the team is getting all sorts of different tax breaks. As Bettina mentioned, they're not going to be paying property taxes. They're going to be getting mortgage recording taxes. They're going to be getting these tax-exempt bonds that we've been talking about, which is actually a tremendous amount of money. If they get the new $300 million in bonds they're looking for, they're going to be talking about getting more than $300 million worth of tax breaks just on the bonds themselves. So when you add it all up, you get somewhere around $900 million worth of public money that's being spent just on Yankee Stadium.
Bettina, those who advocate these stadiums say, why not? This is economic development, it's creating jobs, it's keeping a sort of a the psychology of the city by having a professional sports team that the residents can root for. What's wrong with it?
All the subsidies that Neil just listed, you would like to assume that the city and the state made a clear path to making sure that there were going to be jobs, good paying jobs for New Yorkers on the other end. That was going to be the investment, right? We see nothing. There's nothing that says a certain number of jobs has to be set aside for either local New York residents or local Bronx residents or the number of jobs at all. The city has really washed their hands of making sure there's any accountability on jobs and clear benefits for New Yorkers on the other side of this project, which is very unfortunate. I mean, we're grateful for Congressman Kucinich and Assemblymember Brodsky to get involved in this issue. Neither represent New York City, by the way. New York City elected officials, they're filling a void because local elected officials in New York City have refused to get involved in this project. And we need them. We need them to make sure that the promises in the press releases actually turn out to be something that we can hold our hold them accountable for.
And you have, generally speaking, on this issue of tax-exempt financing for economic development, raised numerous questions over the years. It's been one of my favorite topics, how cities are siphoning off their tax bases to create special deals for developers, and whether it's sports teams or private companies, where they're, in essence, siphoning off the existing tax base from the municipal government and using it to fund special projects. How rampant is this, not only in New York, but throughout the country?
It's a terrible issue regarding not only the issue of financing, but making sure that there are quality jobs for Americans and, in our case, in New Yorkers. There's something called the economic war among the states, where it seems that so many municipalities and states are worrying about fighting one another for the headquarters of a particular agency that they're willing to set aside basic fiscal common sense and not making sure that there are real quality jobs on the ends of these deals. Site consultants are prevalent throughout the country that have really manufactured this process, and they make it seem like if the Yankees didn't get their subsidy or if the New York Stock Exchange didn't get a subsidy, they were going to flee somewhere else without taking into consideration or doing some real due diligence. Where were the Yankees going to go? The Yankees are famous because they're in the Bronx. We have large media here. We have an incredible fan base here. And it seems none of that was taken in consideration before this huge giveaway was done.
Well, that's one of the things I think Assemblyman Brodsky is trying to investigate, because the city agency that engineered this deal, the Industrial Development Authority, apparently said that the Yankees were threatening to leave New York. Of course, the most expensive media market in the country, the most desirable media market in the country. Neil, your sense of whether that was real or not?
Yeah, I mean, and I think everyone knows that the Yankees were not going to move out of New York City, and it's kind of been an open secret for decades now, as long as George Steinbrenner has been demanding a stadium. Where is he going to go? The Yankees are not worth the whatever $1 billion that they're worth if they move to Charlotte, North Carolina. But that was the pretense, and the Yankees actually told the judge in a case trying to stop the demolition of the parks, well, if you try and hold up this case, the Yankees could move. And, you know, they've been allowed to get away with this, and as Bettina was saying, elected officials never challenged them on this until, you know, recently Brodsky has been trying to track it down.
And of course, the final irony of all of this is in the new stadium, once it gets built, as with all these stadiums, the ticket prices for the average baseball fan have go through the roof. The prices in Yankee Stadium for box seats now are astronomical. They're astronomical now, but the what they will cost in the new stadium is unbelievable. Could you talk about some of the prices that they've released so far?
Yeah, I mean, they're talking over, you know, $1,000, $2,000 a seat for some of the really premium seats. And I think what you're going to see is...
For one game.
For one game, yes. For one game, yes, absolutely. For a whole season, you know, all bets are off. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, what you're going to see the Yankees do, they've promised to keep bleacher tickets low. They promised to keep a certain number of, you know, $25 or less seats. I think what you're going to see them do is, especially with Brodsky and everyone else paying attention to the, you know, soaring costs, I think you're going to see the Yankees keep ticket prices low for the first season or two and, you know, try to say, okay, we're holding the line. And then as everybody's clamoring to get tickets, 2-3 years down the road, you'll see those start to creep up. So what I'm worried about isn't next year, is it going to be affordable, but 3 years from now, is anybody going to be able to get a ticket?
Right. And then, of course, the final irony with this, because most of these stadiums have luxury boxes that are for corporations that go from 500 to 800,000, in case of the Yankees, per year to rent these boxes. And, of course, my newspaper, The News, reported yesterday that in this deal, the city of New York arranged to have its own luxury box at Yankee Stadium, available presumably to city officials as part of the deal for the financing. Bettina, your response to that?
It's aptly coined the landlord suite. Mm-hmm. And it's just another example of how local elected officials almost seem to be void of feeling that they have responsibility to the public, because they're going to get nice seats in the long run.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us. Bettina Damiani, the project director of Good Jobs in New York, and Neil DeMause, who's a writer and the author of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. When we come back, a new report from a prominent AIDS organization accuses the federal government of doing too little to fight AIDS among African Americans. And we'll also look at why the majority of African American Latino families are at risk of falling out of the middle class. Stay with us.
Something going on, the matter serious now. This one no be joke, yo. This disease they kill now. AIDS, my brothers, this disease they for real. Now if you love yourself, you better protect yourself. Come, my brothers, listen to me. Come, my sister, do you hear me? But if you must do shot, you better cover your bamboo for AIDS, my brothers. This disease, they for real. Think of the consequence. You better protect yourself. Come, come, my sisters, do you hear me? Come on, my children, do you hear me?
Stop AIDS by Femi Kuti, here in Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. President Bush is expected to sign a bill today that will extend the administration's global AIDS initiative, which has spent about $19 billion overseas in the past 5 years. The bill would extend the AIDS program and authorize the spending of an additional $48 billion over the next 5 years in 15 countries around the world, most of them in Africa. This comes as a new report from a prominent AIDS organization accuses the federal government of doing too little to fight AIDS among African Americans. The 55-page report by the Black AIDS Institute is titled Left Behind, Black America, a Neglected Priority in the Global AIDS Epidemic. It finds that the number of African Americans infected with HIV exceeds the number of people with the virus in 7 of the 15 countries served by the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, known as PEPFAR. According to the report, if blacks in the United States constituted their own country, that nation would rank 16th in the world in number of people living with HIV. 2% of adult black Americans are infected with the virus, and only 4 countries outside of Africa have a higher HIV prevalence. Kai Wright is a freelance journalist based in Brooklyn and is the publications editor of the Black AIDS Institute. He helped compile the report. He also has an article in the July issue of the American Prospect titled America's AIDS Apartheid. Kai Wright joins me in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kai, can you, some of the key findings of the report, and especially the amazing contradiction of President Bush earmarking all this extra money for Africa while the administration appears to be ignoring the situation right here at home.
Right. I mean, it should be clear that the point of the report isn't to say that we shouldn't be involved in the global epidemic. And, you know, the reality is that the United States was asleep at the wheel on that end of things for far too long as well. And so, as a nation, we should, in fact, be applauded for what we're doing globally. With PEPFAR and before PEPFAR, PEPFAR being the president's plan, we should be applauded for that work. The problem is that at the same time that we've begun to scale up this investment globally, we have, in some cases, scaled down our investment domestically, and in all cases held it flat. That's since 2001. It's now 2008. And as that's been happening, the U.S. epidemic has been growing by at a minimum of 40,000 new infections a year. And we have every reason to believe the number's higher than that.
And what is the extent of government support for AIDS treatment in the African-American community? Are there clear figures on that as opposed to the general society?
Well, it's hard to break out the money to say, you know, what goes to here. It's hard to break out the money by race. We can say a few things. We can say that the overall domestic epidemic, even if you don't break out the numbers by race, we're not spinning on par with the growth of the epidemic. You know, again, if the epidemic is growing by 40,000 a year, at least according to the CDC, the money, the budget for treatment for people who are uninsured or people who are low income has not grown at all in that time period. At the same time, we see some of the infrastructure that we built to deal with the domestic epidemic falling apart. You know, so the program we have that helps folks who are uninsured get meds has a waiting list every year. It's a state level program. The waiting lists develop at state level every year, hundreds deep. People have died on the waiting list in South Carolina. That's the only state that it's at least has acknowledged it. So we see the apparatus falling apart, and we know that the overall epidemic is disproportionately African American.
And also within the African American community, the increasing numbers of women that are affected as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, both women and gay men are the hardest hit areas. I believe the number stands at 2/3 of cases amongst women in the United States are black. And that's at all different age groups. I'm going to get the stat wrong now, but age remains a leading cause of death for African American women who are, I believe, 25 to 44. So it's disproportionately hitting black women. It's disproportionately hitting black gay men. We've seen in some cases, in one study that the CDC did a couple years ago, looking at HIV infection amongst gay men in 7 cities, they tested a bunch of gay men, gay and bisexual men, and 46% of the black men they tested were already HIV positive. 46%.
The report makes clear that if black America were a separate nation, it would rank among the nations with the highest incidence of AIDS in the world. Could you expound on that?
Well, I mean, that's one of the striking things that we realized as we started figuring out how to talk about this domestic epidemic that we assume is that everyone assumes is under control. If you look at the United States and if you look at the West in general, you can make a good case about what we've done, about what we've accomplished. With the dramatic dropping of the infection rates, the dramatic dropping of the death rates. But if you break out Black people by all of these measures that we look at it globally, Black people are doing have an epidemic that reflects the one in the developing world. When you look at the levels of infection, when you look at things like how long it takes before people get into treatment, if you look at the way the infection spreads in the Black community versus in the generalized population, by all of these different measures, the Black epidemic looks like one in the developing world. And it's time that we start thinking about it that way, as we start saying, well, we have to target our funds for this. It's a long multi-year battle. We've got multi-generation battle. We've got to target our funds. We need to start thinking about both as government and as private funders about targeting the Black community as a part of the global epidemic.
And we've mentioned the failures of the federal government overall. What about the elected officials within the African-American community, the Congressional Black Caucus and others? Where have they been as this epidemic has been accelerating?
I mean, interestingly, the Congressional Black Caucus, not just those elected officials, but also at the state and local level, and then outside of elected officials and some of the Black leadership, have really in the last 4 or 5 years started stepping up to the plate. Black community, the Black leadership, has been rightly faulted throughout the course of this epidemic for taking too long to get involved, taking too long to realize that Black people were disproportionately impacted. But we have seen a real turn in that in the last 4 or 5 years, where a number of CBC leaders, Barbara Lee, Maxine Waters, there's a good long list, are really out front. Barbara Lee is one of the folks who signed on to this report as an introduction. So we're starting to see some real leadership from the Black Caucus, and we'll see where it goes.
Well, I want to thank you. Now, you're going to stay with us for our next segment, because we want to talk about the vast majority of African-American and Latino middle-class families that are at risk of falling out of the middle class altogether. Only 1 in 4 African-Americans and 1 in 5 Latino middle-class families in America are financially secure. That's according to a new report by the Policy Center, DEMOS, and the Institute for Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. It's called Economic Insecurity, the Experience of the African-American and Latino Middle Classes, and is the first comprehensive report to examine economic stability of households of color in this country. The report measures financial security by rating assets, educational achievements, healthcare costs, budgets, and housing costs. To find out more, we're joined here in our Firehouse studio by Jennifer Weary. She's a senior fellow at DEMOS and one of the co-authors of the report, and journalist Kai Wright, who's also still with us. His latest article for The Nation is called Subprime Swindle. It traces the impact of the mortgage crisis on the Black middle class. And welcome to the Democracy Now. Jennifer, could you tell us some of the main findings, especially in terms of the indicators that you use to judge the security of the Black and Latino middle classes?
Sure. What we wanted to do in this report was to to define the middle class not just as a construct of income or of occupation, which is the way it's usually defined, but as a lifestyle or a certain amount of security and stability in your life. Like being able to meet your expenses today, to develop a nest egg for tomorrow, put your kids through school, and so forth. And to do that, we looked at the factors that you outlined. And what we found was, when we compared the situation of white middle class families to African Americans and Latinos, there were vast differences. And what was astounding to us was really looking at these are African American and Latino families that by all sense and purposes have achieved the American dream. people who, you know, have two earners, two professional earners in the household, you know, maybe are trying to own a home or do own a home, you know, very have achieved all the aspirations that we typically go for. But even among those people, when we look at, you know, where they're weak economically, we found that about 2 in 5 Latino middle-class families are in danger of falling out of the middle class. They're so financially vulnerable, don't have assets. Maybe somebody in the household isn't insured. And 1 in 3 African-American middle-class families are also in danger, so vulnerable, so weak, that they're in danger of falling out of the middle class.
And what are the key factors of the of vulnerability that they face?
Assets for us was really astounding. We found that almost 90% of African-American and Latino families don't have enough assets to cover just, not even all, but just the majority of their essential expenses for even 3 months, you know, if they had to live on those assets alone in case of a job loss or some other sort of unforeseen crisis. And for us, that's an area of extreme, extreme vulnerability and extreme concern, because that's really, the importance of assets is something that allows families to, again, weather current crises, but then also plan for the future and also give future generations a good start.
I think one of the things that I noted in the report was how much of whatever assets African Americans and Latinos have are tied up with whatever equity they have in their homes. That's as right. opposed to any other kind of assets, whether it's cash in the bank or stocks or bonds or whatever, but that essentially the wealth that exists in Black and Latino America is basically the wealth and the equity of their houses, right?
Right, right. One of the stats that I've heard is about 2/3 of the wealth of African American and Latinos are tied up in their homes. You know, when we put this report out and we looked at the net worth that people had, this was the data that we had to use was before the subprime meltdown and the things that are going on now, and so it's really you know, interesting to us, but also frightening to get to the point where we'll be able to take a look that really incorporates the recent meltdown.
Well, and that, Kai, is a good segue to you, because you've been writing about the meltdown and its impact on African Americans and Latinos, and it's been basically devastating across the country, to especially, quote, middle-class communities, hasn't it?
Well, I mean, one thing to note about subprimes is it didn't matter what income you were. At low income, middle income, and high income, African Americans and Latinos were 2 and 3 times more likely to get a subprime loan. And as we know from the Wall Street Journal's reporting, many of them also would have qualified for prime loans, but were steered into it. And it is really quite depressing and concerning what is going to happen in the future because of how much of home equity is how much wealth is dependent upon home equity. As our communities get hit with these foreclosures, it is not just a static moment. It is not just right now that's going to matter. This is going to echo for potentially generations of people. You know, we had already sort of spent so much time clawing back through homes from the ways in which the racist, from our long and predatory history of racist lending. We spent so much time clawing back from that. And now, in one fell swoop, we could very well be right back to where we were before we started, before the Community Reinvestment Act in 1977, before we started creating avenues for African Americans and Latinos and other people of color to try to get some capital. It's really quite scary where we're headed.
And there have been, though, repeated crises of this type seem to feed off the abuses in home lending. Because I remember in the 1970s, there was a huge crisis of FHA-backed mortgages that basically left many areas of the inner city with thousands and thousands of abandoned houses. Again, predatory lenders at that time was abusing FHA financing for loans, which required very little down payment, as opposed to now these refinancings of home equities. But this appears to be far deeper and as you say, more potentially long-lasting than any of the previous crises.
Well, on scale, I mean, I think because it dovetailed with all the other stuff going on in the market, it reached a scale that is particularly troubling. But as you point out, predatory lending is not nothing new in communities of color. This has been arguably the entirety of the history of the mortgage industry has been part of its business model has been predatory behavior in communities of color. And so that's an important thing to remember. We now have our supposed fix from Congress. And it's a, you know, and it's as good bill as far as it goes. But the Fed has stepped in to do some regulating of some of the things, the abuses that went on with the subprime loans. But this is a beast that must be constantly watched, because you can bet that the next time there's a dime to be made about on preying on these communities, that lenders will do it again. And so we're going to have to stay vigilant.
And Jennifer Weir, I'd like to ask you also about the healthcare aspect of the indicators that you use. Obviously, the healthcare crisis continues to expand in terms of the number of people that are not insured. How has this affected the African American and Latino communities in terms of their economic stability?
Well, that's even one of the factors that we looked at, because if a family has even one member uninsured, if something happens to that person, all of a sudden the family's resources, which, you know, as we've talked about, are very limited, their assets are going to be drawn into helping that person. And we found that almost one in three African American families have at least one family member that's uninsured. And for Latino families, I believe it's two out of five families. And for us, again, these are...
And compared to the average white family, what's...
The average white family, about 20%. So there's still a substantial amount of white families. But again, if you look at the disproportionate nature of things, it's incredibly troublesome.
And in terms of the possible solutions that you offer in terms of assuring better stability among these those who have managed to progress to a certain level?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as Kai said, I think that looking at predatory lending is absolutely essential. And it's the housing crisis and what's happened with mortgages is not to put too much of a pun out there, but it's a prime example. But additionally, there are other aspects of lending. I mean, there's payday loans in neighborhoods. And there's also, I think, the credit card sector we have to look at as well. We have another report out which looks at the fact that high-cost credit cards are really targeted and disproportionately held by African American and Latino families.
And Kai, your sense of what could be some of the policy decisions that would help in this area of providing more security for those middle class families?
Well, I mean, quickly to piggyback on what Jennifer said, I mean, one of the interesting things about the subprime loans and getting people into them was that there was that a lot of the folks were being targeted, saying, "Hey, look, you got all this credit card debt, which they got from predatory behavior. Mm-hmm. You should roll that over into you should take borrow against your home to pay that off."
Right.
So it, one builds upon the next, builds upon the next. Now, if you drive around neighborhoods where there's lots of foreclosures, you see an eruption of all of these folks are coming, who put up flyers and say, "Hey, are you in trouble? Come to us. We'll buy up your house real quick." You know,
so there's a new predatory wave on top of all the
they
others.
They just build one upon another. Arguably, the subprime stuff came out of the reaction, the Community Reinvestment Act. Demanded that banks start lending in these neighborhoods. They immediately came up with ways to do it in a predatory way. You know, so it's one flows from the next. So solutions, one, we have to not assume that because we passed some regulations this week that we're done with this problem, we can go back to our business. Two, this bill's gonna help 400,000 people. There are maybe 400,000 people. There are something like 2 million barreling towards foreclosure. A huge number of those are African American, Latino. African Americans and Latinos are expected to absorb about half the nation's loss from this. So something's going to have to happen to the families that are still coming. So we're not done with figuring out how to stop the bleeding.
And I've been surprised. We've got about 30 seconds. How little at the local leadership level, political leaders, how slowly they have moved, even though they've been recognizing this now for more than 2 years. How slowly they've moved on trying to come up with fixes at the state levels or to deal with some of this, especially with the subprime crisis. Any thoughts on that?
I think that there's been a lot of activity, sort of playing a bit of a shell game about who's to blame for these things. But now we have so many pieces of bad news converging that local leaders really need to step back and take a look and take action.
Yeah. Okay, well, I want to thank both of you very much for being with us. Kai Wright, he's a Brooklyn-based journalist. His latest piece for The Nation magazine is titled The Subprime Swindle. Jennifer Weary is a senior fellow with Demos and co-author of a new report called Economic Insecurity, The Experience of the African American and Latino Middle Classes. And that does it for today's program. If you want to get a copy of the show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy will be back next week on Monday. She's on a long-deserved vacation. Thanks for joining us and for another edition of Democracy Now!